Hello, and welcome to Mornings with Joel, Commercial Real Estate Podcast, where we focus on rising stars and established players in commercial real estate and talk to them about how they are building legacies in today's marketplace. All right, so hey, welcome to the Mornings with Joel CRE Podcast. We're really excited today. We have an old buddy of mine, Ken Bacon, who's decided to join us here in the studio. So what's happening, Ken? How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Just glad I'm in the D.C. area and not burning up in my native state of Texas and are drowning in the Midwest. So I'm doing fine.
You know, getting blown away by a tornado in the Midwest, too. It's been kind of crazy this year. Yeah. So good stuff. Good stuff. We'll talk about Texas a little bit later because I know you're active down there. So that's kind of exciting. But, you know, I was just sitting here and I'm kind of wondering, when's the last time we actually saw each other? I don't think it was I was thinking it was Martha's Vineyard, but I think it's been since then. Were you out in L.A. back in April?
No, I didn't make it.
Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So maybe it was Martha's Vineyard or we ran into each other somewhere else. I don't know. But anyway, it's all good. So for our guests that don't know, you know, as we mentioned, we kind of tagged this as, you know, Ken Bacon, the godfather of multifamily real estate. so, you know, and we can laugh about it, but, you know, you've been a bad boy as a pathfinder for many, many years. So if you don't mind, tell our audience who you are for those who may not know you. Okay. And then we'll dive into a little bit about your background and whatnot after
that. Well, currently I'm... I kind of say there are two roles that take up a lot of my time. I'm the managing partner of Realfield Realty Partners, which is a firm that I started with a couple other guys in 2014. Mm-hmm. That's a multifamily boutique. We invest in apartments on behalf of some pensions, some family offices. And so that's kind of my day job. But the other thing, I serve on several boards, but the board that probably takes the most time is I'm a chairman of Welltower, which is a large health care, non-executive chairman of that. Mm-hmm. So those are the two things that really take up a lot of time. You know, just so people won't think it's crazy, why would you call me the godfather of the multifamily? But up till 2012, I ran the multifamily division at Fannie Mae. I'd run that for a dozen years. So that's what kind of got me into this business.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see here. Oh, so you were saying that you ran Fannie Mae's multifamily business for years. I think that's probably where you were most well known for, that gap period of time of doing that. Mm-hmm. But the question is, you know, how do you, as a minority in America, basically, how in the world do you get to the point where you're able to run a large agency like that, and especially the multifamily division when so many of us are not even familiar with commercial real estate here? You know, what was that path that kind of got you to that point to where you were able to do that and have that?
Okay. Well, it was a long path. I finished business school in 1982, and I went to work on Wall Street as an investment banker, but I started in public finance.
Okay.
But what's relevant is that I started out doing tax-exempt housing bonds.
Ah, okay.
So around 1985, when securitization, Lou Ranieri and Larry Fink and everybody, securitization was really taking off, the firm I was at, Kidder Peabody, had some great traders, some of whom, like Mike Vranos, Tommy Kendall, Steve Baum, later went on to great careers, but they didn't have a banker. So they assigned me to be the banker to do all the SEC filings, capital commitment memos, oversee the closings. So that's how I got into securitization.
Okay.
And I left Kidder Peabody in 1987 to go to Morgan Stanley. Mm-hmm. But 1990 comes around, a lot of the savings and loans were going under, who had been like kind of a big client base. And so I left to go into government.
Okay.
Resolution Trust Corporation was around. So I went there as director of policy for the board of the RTC, which was an incredible experience because the board was Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Fed, Nick Brady, secretary of the Treasury, Jack Kemp, secretary of HUD, the two outside members, one of whom was Bob Larson, who was the head of the Taubman organization. Mm-hmm. So I got to operate at a very high level and we approved a securitization program, but there was no one to run it. So I left the board and went over and ran that securitization program. And we were the first people to really securitize commercial mortgages at scale. That exposed me to Fannie Mae. So when my time in government, when my money was running out, I had to go back to make a living. Yeah. Fannie Mae came along and I didn't want to go back to Wall Street. So I went to Fannie Mae. I ran a region for 6 years, but unlike everybody else in Fannie Mae, the way Fannie Mae was organized then, you had single family and multifamily under you. But because of my background packaging up commercial loans, I took an active interest in multifamily. And so when Frank Raines became chairman, first Black, kind of one of the first Black CEOs of a Fortune 500 company, he brought me down to D.C. and I spent a year getting our community development funding straight where we were doing equity deals. And then I moved to multifamily. It's a long winded way, but the reason I like to stress it is that, sometimes your career takes you down paths that you don't. I never dreamed, in other words, going to Fannie Mae. It happened. Mm-hmm. But I had the right background at the right time. And Fannie Mae's commitment, that Shakespeare line, the good, the evil that men does lives after them. The good is often interred with their bones. Mm-hmm. When people talk about Fannie Mae now, they talk about the financial crisis and its role. But one of the outstanding things about Fannie Mae was the diversity of its workforce. And you see it today. If you go to J.P. Morgan Chase, mm-hmm. Vince Toy, who's in charge of the community lending and the agency lending, used to work for me at Fannie Mae. Okay. Brian McLaughlin at Enterprise. Brian Kenner at Amazon, who was involved with their affordable housing initiative. Mm-hmm. I could just go on and on. The head of single family mortgage business at Wells Fargo for a while, Christy Williams-Furco, used mm-hmm. to be at Fannie Mae, chief operating officer of T. Rowe Price. Kimberly Johnson used to be one of the credit people for multifamily. I could just go on and on about wow. the number of Black people and women who worked at Fannie Mae who ended up in positions. So I owe Fannie Mae a big vote of thanks for giving me a platform that exposed me to a lot of people.
Yeah. No, that's really, really impressive, from that standpoint, being able to build that foundation and not just benefit yourself, but benefit others as well and give them the training to be able to spin out. So that's certainly appreciative of what you did there. We appreciate what you did there. I did want to circle back to one thing that was kind of noteworthy. You left Kidder Peabody in 87 and went to Morgan Stanley. I was working on Wall Street at U.S. Trust in 87. And what was going on back there? I'll let you tell the story back in 87 as to where that, there was a lot going on back in 87, which is around that time that you made that transition and probably precipitated making that move.
Well, it was funny. What made me leave Kidder was that GE had bought the firm. Mm-hmm. The culture of the firm changed and I wasn't forced out. In fact, people thought I was crazy to leave. And maybe in hindsight, I was. Mm-hmm. But the culture just became very political. And so I went to Morgan Stanley, I think it was in like the spring of 87. And the markets were a little unsteady, but I remember when the stock market crash of 87 happened and I was on the trading floor. And I remember everybody just stopped working and you were just watching the ticker, just prices go down and down and down. And it was a scary time because, that led to some cutbacks. Mm-hmm. It led to reductions in comp, but fortunately I was not on the equity side. My business held up, but it was also a lesson because I think a lot of times people look at the compensation, whether it was investment banking then, or private equity and venture capital now, and I always tell folk that younger people that when they pay you a lot of money, they are paying you that money for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's high risk, high reward. Yeah. And 87 brought that home because you saw people, what happened to people. Mm-hmm. And, when you work in finance for any firm, that's whether it's a bank or whether it's a PE firm, a VC firm, these people aren't there to give you lifetime employment. They're all about making money. And when they ain't making money, they get the axe out.
Yeah, Yeah.
And I've been through enough. I mean, whether it's the 87, the Russian bond crisis, 9/11, the financial crisis of 2008, the pandemic, I've been through enough things that, you know, I know how to survive. And that's what 87 was about. It was all about surviving.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the irony of that, I remember walking up Maiden Lane and, you know, people are looking up at the windows, making sure nobody's jumping out. You know, it was crazy.
That's right.
Back at that time. Right. Yeah, it was nuts. But you know, I bring that up and I'm actually glad you took us down that path, because the ability to survive these different crises over time is important, you know, and being able to see, you know, and you always think, well, this is the end, this is it. But then somehow things turn around and things get better again, and you kind of move through it. During the time of the RTC issue, with all that was going on back there, obviously you were right in the middle of that as well. How do you think that compares with the times that we're dealing with right now? We saw a couple of bank failures, but how do you think that stacks up in comparison?
I think on one hand, you could say it was worse because, you know, savings and loans were going down all over the country. Mm-hmm. The government stepped in, had to play a big role. It was the first time since really the Depression that something like that had happened. So you could say it was worse. On the other hand, I'd say the fact that the government did step in swiftly, they did create an RTC, and that created a lot of opportunities for people. It helped jumpstart the commercial mortgage securitization market. I mean, I look at some of the people I dealt with, like Wes Edens, who started Fortress, was a trader. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these people, I mean, the people I dealt with, you know, Ranieri, Fink, Mike Mortera, who's passed away, but there were a lot of heavyweights in the mortgage industry, mm-hmm. and this really gave them a huge platform. So it created an opportunity, which is one lesson I always tell people. Anytime there's a crisis, some assets are going to be mispriced, and that's an opportunity. Yeah. The other thing that came out of the RTC was I had the power, because of my relationship with the board, to set up a program where I was able to help a lot of municipal Black firms and women-owned firms and Latin firms that have been relegated to doing municipal finance. I was able to get them in bond deals. So people like Ron Blaylock, John Utendahl were really able to get out of just doing muni deals or some crumbs on a corporate deal and get into a bigger market. What's worse today, though, is the fact that there's so much uncertainty. Mm-hmm. For example, if we look at Silicon Valley Bank, we look at the other banks, you know, in RTC, there was a program. The assets were bid out publicly. They were securitized. There was minority participation. Mm-hmm. Today, you know, that's not happening.
No.
We're not getting a chance to step up and you know, swing the bat and try to get those deals. I mean, it's all gone to BlackRock. Chase, et cetera. And so I'm not saying our firms get a shot. The other thing is the savings and loan thing happened. Everybody knew, here are the rules. Mm-hmm. And right now there's a lot of haziness, uncertainty, mm-hmm. because you know that there are weak banks out there, but the government's holding off because they don't want to create a crisis of confidence. So then it was like, I still remember being part of teams that would go in, they would go into a savings and loan on Friday and say, mm-hmm. we're taking over and you're going to open up Monday morning under a new name, a new executive team. And I would lead a team in there sometimes on the weekends to go in there and say, okay, here's what they have in terms of assets.
Yeah.
So it was kind of organized. It was programmatic. Mm-hmm. And you don't have that kind of program today. So that's the thing that might make it a little worse.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that they'll get their act together with that, or is things just going to kind of play out and see what happens? And how do you think rates are going to play into this as well? Because obviously we still don't know whether rates are going to continue to go up or freeze or what.
Well, I think one thing that's happened today that makes things very different. One, we came out of the pandemic, and typically when a crisis happens, the government pumps more money in. Well, they can't do that now because they pump money in for the pandemic. Not only to increase the deficit, that's one of the things that fueled inflation.
Inflation, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the economy is also making a pivot now because everyone's trying to bring manufacturing back in. So if you look at the root causes of inflation, you know, we had the government pumping a lot of money, money supply expanded rapidly. We had supply chain disruptions being dependent, overly dependent probably on China. So we're trying to bring that in. That costs money. And then something that people don't talk about is immigration. Canada has said, come out publicly and said, you know what? Legal immigration is a great thing because that's going to fuel our economic growth. Canada, which is about, I don't know, 1/10, 1/12 the population of the U.S., is letting in about the same number of legal immigrants as we are.
Oh, wow.
And if you look at the sources of wage inflation, you know, look, I'm from Texas. If you look at what built California and Texas wealth, it was cheap labor from Mexico. It was one of the things that helped. The tech companies are very dependent on engineering talent from Asia. All of a sudden, you're making it harder for that labor to come in. That helps drive up wages. So you've got wages, you've got supply chain, you've got money supply. So the Fed is a little bit handcuffed. I personally think they're going to keep, they paused on the rates because of the weakness in the banking system. Are concerned about the perception of weakness in the banking system. But I think they're going to have to keep raising rates because inflation has really not gone down. They haven't hit the target yet.
Yeah, yeah, which is something that, you know, most of us don't want to hear, especially if you're trying to do development. But, you know, that's it is what it is, right?
Well, Joel, you know, I mean, advantage of being old is that when I hear people say something about the rates, when I started on Wall Street in 1982, interest rates were double digit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember when people, it was a huge celebration when rates, when, you know, you could get long-term corporate debt at 6 or 7%. So historically, the problem is the rates we have now, it's like we've been on dope, right? It's like people going out and giving everybody like, here, here's some dope, feel good, right? And then one day they took the needle away.
Yeah.
And so I think that we just did a deal the other day. We've done two deals this year. It's hard, but I think the real issue is that psychologically, people haven't adjusted to this rate environment. You know, your development deal would be a lot easier to do if the people selling land or all of a sudden those prices went down.
Yeah.
But what I see happening in real estate is that a lot of people are hesitating to sell at what I consider a realistic price because everybody remembers what it was like 2 years ago.
Right.
And they feel, oh, I'm going to lose money if I do. So I think if, you know, the minute people realize that, you know what, we're not going back to 2% money or 3% money, I think things will get better.
Okay. All right. So really, and that's true. I mean, people do have a short memory. And, you know, you give it enough time and things should get back. So that's a good point. Hopefully everybody will adjust to that because you're right. I mean, rates for a long time were, you know, 8+%, you know, and now we're kind of right back there and it's like, you know, end of the world. So but it's not really that way. So we'll see what happens there. You know, you mentioned something also about, you know, in crisis is certainly the time to buy. I mean, we all know that. Philosophically, right? You buy low, you sell high, you know, that type of thing. But there's still one challenge that I always see is that a lot of times you have the challenge of having that dry powder available when those opportunities arise. So what would you tell to our listeners and the audience about how do you help mitigate that in certain challenges? Or is there a way to do it? Or do you have to team up with a Ken Bacon? Or I mean, what do you do?
I wish I could tell people I had enough money to tell people to team up with me, but I don't. You know, when I started this business, when you're at a place like Fannie Mae, you never worry about having funds.
Right.
I'm an entrepreneur, and what I used to call it is knee pad chapstick time. In other words, you're on your knees begging chapstick because you're having to kiss a lot of behinds. And so the thing is, if you look out, you know, Blackstone, for example, despite all the problems with the BREIT, still went out and raised a $30 billion fund. So you start looking at the PE firms, and the PE firms are sitting on a lot of money. There are a lot of family offices sitting on a lot of money. The sovereign wealth funds have increased money. So the problem is that some of the usual sources of capital Like if you need debt financing, a lot of banks have tightened up.
Right.
But if you're a multifamily, Fannie and Freddie are still there. Is the underwriting tighter? Yes, but the point is there's still money. Mm-hmm. So I think that the challenge is when you get to times like this, do you have relationships with alternative sources of capital? And in real estate, I still maintain this is a relationship business. You got to know people. Mm-hmm. And one mistake I see people make is that when times are good, I used to tell my staff when we would negotiate with people, always leave a nickel on the table. Don't try to squeeze every penny. Yeah. Let the other party leave the table feeling like they were well treated, because you might do 10 deals with 10 different capital sources, or 10 different sellers. Not all of them are going to appreciate that you did that, but all you need is that one.
Yeah,
it's all you need, one or two people to say, hey, this was a good guy. And that's happened with me as an entrepreneur. We've gotten some deals where we may not have been necessarily the highest bid, but because of a relationship that we had from my days at Fannie, or sometimes it's even all the way back to my Wall Street days, somebody said, hey, how can I help you?
Yeah.
So that's the thing I think is critically important. If you flip the bird to everybody in 2019 and 2020,
yeah,
you're going to be it's going to be very hard for you to do deals in 23. But if you establish some good relationships, whether it's a lender, a pension plan, or some family, I can say there's still money out there. And some deals are going to get done. I mean, it's frozen a little bit right now, but it's going to loosen up. And the question is, you know, do you have a team? Do you have those relationships that you can exploit it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it goes back to some fundamental things, right? It's all about relationships. And yeah. You're 2,000% correct about this business, because if you're unknown, that money's a whole lot slower to flow. You know,
that's right.
That is known. So
that's right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So you have to do that. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, what you can share related to your strategy, you know, for someone like yourself that has been in the business for so long. Mm-hmm. I know you're focused on primarily three parts of the country, you know, almost like the half of the, what do they call it? The Rust Belt, if you will.
Yeah.
What was your logic behind that? And going forward, what kind of strategies are you thinking of as a, you know, seasoned professional in the multifamily space?
Okay. Well, the three partners, myself, John Siegel, and Todd Watkins, John and Todd work with me at Fannie Mae. They left in 2005.
Okay.
But one of the things that we tried to do was to apply what we learned about the business at Fannie Mae. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I learned is that in every downturn, first of all, multifamily always performs better than most asset categories because there's no substitute for it. You know, you look at office, you look at retail, online, but you can't live online. You can't, right. you can't live in a virtual world. You got to have some bricks and mortar. That's number one. Yeah. Number two, though, is that I remember in the financial crisis, there were two categories of multifamily that never had a problem. One was the properties that were owned by the EQRs, the Avalon Bays of the world, because their leverage was low. They weren't at 80%. They were like 60, 65%. They had staying power.
Right.
But the other category was B properties. Mm-hmm. B properties did better. So I'll give you an example. We take Houston, where I'm from. Mm-hmm. Financial crisis comes. If you had an A property, I'm just going to use some numbers because this was several years ago.
Yeah.
You had an A property that was renting for $2,500 a month. Mm-hmm. Person renting that apartment all of a sudden said, wow, my stock options are underwater. I may not get a bonus. Mm-hmm. I don't want to pay $2,500 a month. I want to pay $1,800 a month. So let me go to this older apartment. I don't need the yoga room. I don't need the wine closet.
Yeah.
I don't need the garage parking.
Pool on the roof.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So I can go down. So what I learned is when you have a high-end apartment, the people renting there are renting like, I want this, but I don't need this. When you get into B properties, all of a sudden you get the people, hey, I need to rent and I need a place that's safe. I need a place I can afford. And, you know, that's where I want to be. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we learn that that's very important. The other thing I learned that's important is people will talk about a market in very broad terms. But I noticed, for example, like if I told you, oh, let's go invest in Cleveland, you might say, Cleveland? Oh, my God, I don't want to invest in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. But if you go to Cleveland right now, if you have an apartment building that's next to Case Western University or the Cleveland Clinic, it's going to do great.
Yeah.
Submarkets are critical. So when we started this business, first thing we did was to say, what markets do we want to be in? And I hate when people say, I like being in good markets. And I always say, what's a good market?
Yeah, what's a good market? Yeah.
Well, it's high growth. Well, we came up with 9 variables. We looked at job growth. We looked at construction starts. We looked at net migration. We looked at 9 different variables. And we created this algorithm to score markets. Mm-hmm. And it led us to be ahead of the curve sometime. And we also said it's very important to have a submarket where there's an anchor, something that can't move. Yeah. It might be a university, a hospital, a large Fortune 100 company. Mm-hmm. And to give you an example, when we started, we got money to go into Texas from New York Common through Artemis. Mm-hmm. And I remember we did the ran our algorithm and San Antonio kept popping up on the map. And I remember going to a lot of the biggest players in Texas. And I'd say, well, where are you investing? They'd say, oh, we invest in Austin, Houston, and Dallas. I said, what about San Antonio? Nah, we don't do it. Well, we looked at the numbers and said, San Antonio is a great place. So we bought in San Antonio in 2014 and 2015. Our deal in 2015 was the biggest deal anybody from out of the city did that year.
Wow.
Right? And by the way, this was not, I think it was $60-something million. But when we got ready to sell in 2018, all of a sudden, CBRE, Blackstone, everybody had discovered San Antonio. And if you look what happened, Austin got so hot that it just drifted down throughout the whole area.
Yeah.
Same thing happened later on. We went to Richmond. I didn't hear anybody talking about Richmond, but we looked at it and I said, Richmond is a Goldilocks market. Not too hot, you know, never, you know, boomed, but it never went down. And same thing, we got into Richmond. In fact, we just did a deal in Richmond this year. And it's turned out to be a great place to be. And now I just saw a thing yesterday that, oh, Richmond is scheduled for growth in the years ahead. So, you know, my point is that you should never accept conventional wisdom. You should do some analysis. You should do some thinking about what's going to make a deal work. Mm-hmm. And so we like to do deals that are affordable. I don't like to do deals that you have to be what I call the doctor, the CEO, the CFO to afford the rent. Mm-hmm. I like to do the deals that I work for the doctor. I'm a nurse. I'm a teacher. I'm a policeman. What can I afford? Right. So that's number one. Number two is to go to some place where the overall market shows positive signs of growth. Mm-hmm. And there's not too much new construction. So we've never done a deal in Houston. We have deals in Fort Worth. We have deals in Dallas. We have deals in Metro Austin and San Antonio. I haven't done a deal in Houston. Why? Because I looked at the insurance cost. I looked at the building. Even by Texas standards, it's people in Dallas and Austin go, man, Houston's it's too easy to build there. So Houston is what I call a high beta market. Mm-hmm. And so the only time I want to do a deal in Houston, if I could find a deal at a 7 cap, I'd be all over. We didn't see that. So so you have to do your homework about where you're going to go. And that informs your strategy. So we like to say that we do workforce housing, broadly defined. Mm-hmm. We try to do deals where there's an anchor. And we try to go into the larger market where we see that job growth and that stability.
Gotcha. No, that all makes really good sense. And that Austin situation that you mentioned, boy, did that play out. I mean, Austin prices just went absolutely bananas. And I priced a lot of people out of that market because you just couldn't get in.
Yeah, well, if you look at it, at Welltower, the read I chair, Welltower has a team of data scientists. Mm-hmm. And Welltower is extremely, I mean, I look at nine variables, they look at hundreds. Mm-hmm. And they've identified, I asked them to do an analysis one time, and one of the things that comes up is if you look at Austin all the way down this Interstate 35 to mm-hmm. San Antonio, mm-hmm. everything along there is hot now. It's becoming one. It reminds me of what happened to Dallas and Fort Worth.
Fort Worth, yeah.
Back in the 80s, it was Dallas, and you would leave Dallas, go into Fort Worth, and yeah, you'd see some suburbs. But now I just saw an article where Fort Worth is one of the fastest growing cities in the country.
Mm.
And so
bring them together.
You look at it, and you know, when I looked at San Antonio, I remember, well, you know, everybody talks about Austin, University of Texas, but there's the University of Texas San Antonio with 30,000 students. There's the biggest armed services medical complex is in San Antonio. Their military bases. There are other, some smaller universities, St. Mary's, Trinity. Mm-hmm. There's a Toyota has a huge manufacturing hub there. And it's only an hour from Austin. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we knew that as Austin grew, that yeah, some of Austin's gonna go north, but some of it's gonna go south. And you got this major interstate and you've got this base. So like I say, you got to do your homework. And if you do that, you could make some good deals.
Yeah, absolutely. And San Antonio's a cool city anyway. I've always liked San Antonio.
That's right.
They've done a good job down there with the waterfront and everything else, or the mm-hmm. riverfront. I almost lost track of time here. Hey, guys on Zoom and anyone else, if you want to start putting your questions in the chat, we'll open it up for Q&A now as we continue going. But if you have any questions, you could either raise your virtual hand or put those in the chat, and we'll get Ken's take on it as we continue talking here. So you mentioned a couple of other things while those calls are coming in. And I appreciate the strategy. You mentioned B properties, but you didn't mention C. Mm-hmm. Would you do any C value add type deals, or what do you think about that market and that strategy at this time?
Yeah, we will do what I call light value add. In other words, where it's paint, maybe the roof, appliances. Mm-hmm. We try to avoid anything where we got to knock down walls or dig up foundations, because we're a small firm. We just don't have the staff, the expertise. So when we started out, there were two things I wanted to avoid. One is development. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying development is bad, but that's not my wheelhouse.
That's your model.
And because, development, you've got to be all over it. You got to be patient. Clearly, there are people like Jair Lynch, who's done extremely well developing. So here, Bua. A lot of you know Bua.
Up in New York.
Dante's partners, again, has done extremely well with that. We knew what our expertise was. Our expertise was financing. Our expertise was on acquisition. Mm-hmm. We played to that. The C properties, we have done some tax credit deals. So we've done some things with lower rents. We got some money from Citibank. But, C properties, a lot of times, like I say, require a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And I don't care how good a job of due diligence you do, there's always going to be a surprise.
Yeah.
And so on a risk basis for us, that wasn't a space that I was comfortable in. So, another thing I think is key in business, know what you know what you don't know.
Good point. Yeah, really, really good point. And are you looking more at garden style out in the suburbs, or more urban infill, or doesn't matter?
Doesn't really matter. We've got deals. We have a family office we've invested for that likes type A property. So we do have, newly constructed, three, four story apartments in Dallas, Fort Worth, Charleston. I kind of bread and butter though with stuff that maybe was 15 or 20 years old.
Okay.
That we go in and we make the cosmetic changes. And we have a very hands-on, very conservative way that we even approach doing those. you know, one of the things I learned in this business is that some people will go in and they have a standard template that they use whenever they buy an apartment building. Okay, here are the types of appliances, here's the type of finishes. And we spend a lot of time looking at what's going to work. So classic example, when we were looking at Houston, I'd see properties in Houston and people would pay up for stainless steel appliances, right? They wanted that modern kind of look. Mm-hmm. I got to San Antonio, we discovered, you know what? People ain't going to pay up for it. They like it, but they're not going to pay an extra $150 in rent because you got some, you know, so stuff like your backsplash, your counters, your light fixtures. We learned that you have to spend time and see what works, because what's hot in Houston, people may not pay for in San Antonio. What works in a type A apartment where you're going to have a certain demographic may not work in that B apartment. So you have to really spend a lot of time figuring out what amenities, what finishes work. And one of the ways I do that, I call it the common man approach. Uh-huh. So when we used to go out and look at a lot of properties, I would literally pull up in an area and I would just go look at 10 or 15 properties in the day. And most people were, I'd say, look, I'm an investor. I'm thinking about investing in this area. Most of the leasing agents, the property managers would show you around. But at the end of every visit, I would turn to them and say, you know what? If I gave you a blank sheet of paper, right, what would you do here, right? And I'd have mm-hmm. people say, oh, I'd have a dog park. Oh, I'd put a backsplash in the apartments. Oh, I'd have an outdoor grill. And then I'd say, well, why do you do that? Because they say, well, we found that people like that. They'll pay up for that. So there's market research you can do, but a lot of times you just have to get out on the ground and ask people. Mm-hmm. And while that sounds easy, if you look at the heat in Texas, I remember once being in San Antonio, it was like 100 degrees and going to look at apartments. That was not a fun day.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. So, you know, it's funny, we're actually, this is a deal with financing. We're not actually, it's not one of my personal deals, but it's in Dallas. We're actually closing tomorrow on it. And one of the value adds is centralized air because of what's going on right now. I mean, just have a wall unit in one room and try to filter through the house, it's just not happening, you know? Yeah. So you gotta make those changes.
Well, I tell you, one of the things I don't think people in our business, I mean, people talk about it, but I don't think people really think through the ramifications is climate change. Mm-hmm. You know, insurance costs are rising, I think. Big time. And the areas, the hottest growth areas, Florida, Arizona, Texas, that's something you have to think about. But also, you just mentioned one, the air conditioning, the heating, the materials that you use. Mm-hmm. All of these are things that we think about when we make a bid, because when, you know, we bid on an apartment building, we never assume that the insurance costs are going to stay the same. In fact, we bid on one deal that we won, and I remember the insurance was about $300 a door. And we said, okay, we assume that it's going to cost us $500. And when we won, when we got the bid for the insurance, it turned out to be $600.
Oh,
we weren't conservative enough. I just say that to say that whether it's insurance, energy cost, building materials, the type of materials you use, you really do have to think that climate change is here, it's real, and it's going to impact your business.
Yeah, yeah, it ain't going nowhere, that's for sure. So
that's right.
We only have to deal with that. Ms. Redwine has a question here in the box. Let me go ahead and ask her question, and there's a couple of others I was going to ask you.
Okay.
It says, for new REAP commercial graduates, what entry-level positions should they consider, i.e. keywords to seek and job openings to be positioned for these opportunities? I'm not sure exactly what opportunities are. Teresa, are you talking about to be an investor, or what specifically, if you want to elaborate on that? You want to mic yourself? Just go ahead and answer. Yeah.
Yeah, let me start off. In today's world, if I had the chance, if I could get in an area that's dealing with workouts mm-hmm. or dealing with a bridge loan portfolio, I'd do it. I learned more at the RTC. I like to tell people I got a PhD in bad deals. And, you know, there's no substitute for that, because I just give you one simple example. most of the time we go to properties and you go do your due diligence and you let somebody show you the rent rolls, right? And you say, okay, that's good enough. Well, I learned at the RTC, I learned something the hard way. People lie.
Right? You think?
So, you know, I started looking like even today, if it's not some a seller that I know, I'll tell our people, do pull the leases. Don't just take the rent roll. Pull the leases. See what they look like. Look at the bank statements. Let's look at actual cash collections. What do we really see? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, one of the things that happened at the RTC back in the savings and loan crisis, there were a lot of fraudulent loans. You know, it happened in Fannie Mae. Yeah. So, you know, if you can, getting exposure to bad loans is good. But the other thing is, I think it's good to be a lender. I think it's good to be a lender because I'm not knocking starting out on the equity side, but when you're a lender, the first thing you have to do is assess credit. And you have to think about how are we going to get repaid? That forces you to look at cash. I just think that's key. Mm-hmm. Because when you're on the equity side, it's very easy to fall in love with your deals. It's very easy to start saying, yeah, I know the cash flow is a little weak, but I'm going to sell it. You know, we're going to make a killing when we sell it. Well, when you're a lender, you don't think like that. You start thinking, okay, I'm getting ready to lend you like $30 million. How am I going to get repaid?
Yeah. What's the cash flow today, right?
That's right.
That service, yeah.
So I'd say if you can get on that workout side, if you can get where you get exposure to bridge loan portfolio, you can be a lender. I think those are all good jobs. But, you know, in this market, who knows? I mean, not going to be a lot of openings for brokers, but, you know, all these jobs, you'll get exposure. So I'm not going to say they're bad jobs. I just think there's some that are better than others. But, you know, even if you're a broker and you got to sell stuff, you quickly learn how to establish value. So that can be a good experience, too.
Yeah. Good point. Good point. You know, the second part of her question was about interns. Opportunities in the DFW area. You know anything about that? I know that's not your focus, but you know a lot of people.
So
anything like that?
You know, I don't. I teach at Georgetown. I teach a finance course, real estate finance course for the MBA program at Georgetown. Mm-hmm. And I often saw people like the big organizations, you know, Prudential, you know, Pigham, Howard Hughes, some of the big REITs will take interns. Welltower, we would take interns. Geographically, I don't know, but Dallas, Fort Worth, you know, if you go to Dallas, Fort Worth, Atlanta, LA, New York, Chicago, there are so many real estate companies there. You just have to find out who the big players are and knock on a bunch of doors.
Okay. All right. Well, you got your answer. So we'll go with that. Couple of other things real quick as we, you know, begin to kind of wind down. The there's a lot of money floating around out there right now, as you know, for affordable housing, especially mm-hmm. minorities, emerging managers and things like that. What's your thoughts on the using that as a model and a strategy at this point? Or do you generally do like a portion affordable, like 20% or something like that? Or, you know, do you have any focus on that? Or is it purely market rate?
Let me answer this carefully because I don't want this to come off wrong. I look at my good friend, Daryl Carter, who has built a phenomenal business doing affordable. Mm-hmm. Phenomenal. It can be a great business. I think the thing that bothers me about affordable today is when you're Black and you show up at a big institution, they automatically want to start talking to you about affordable. Yeah. You notice I said we're a multifamily boutique. I don't even use the word emerging manager because when you say when you're emerging, the programs are set up, oh, we're going to give you 20 million. Yeah. We'll give you 40 million. And when I started, I remember that Victor McFarland and Quentin Primo and Daryl Carter, all these guys said, yeah, you get just enough money to go broke. And what they meant is that until you get up to a couple hundred million dollars of, you know, equity under management, the fees that you generate are $50 million. That's not enough to pay yourself a salary, pay staff, pay rent, pay insurance. And what enabled us to survive is that, you know, I was older, my kids were out of school. I had corporate boards. My two partners had interest in an outside business. So we all had sources of income. So we could just plow our money back into the business.
Yeah.
But, you know, you really make money in this business when you sell. Mm-hmm. If you're a developer, when you sell, acquisition, that's when you get your promote. And hopefully you make some money then. Right. It's hard to hang on. And the problem with doing these emerging manager programs, you don't get enough money. You know, you'll notice you hear a lot of emerging manager programs. You don't hear enough programs about, hey, you've been an emerging manager. We're going to help take you to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people like Jair, like Bull, if you ask them, I mean, it's fascinating. I don't know if you had them on to say what it took. For us, it just took years.
Yeah.
Finally, started getting enough capital. And some of that was just a result of hard work and perseverance. Sometimes it was luck. But our first few years, you know, you would talk to people, and I still remember, I won't even mention the state. One state, they had this brother running this emerging manager program. He said, come in. They sent me a 20-page application. And I remember calling him up, and I said, you know, what is this, right?
Yeah, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, they wanted to make you jump through all these hoops. Mm-hmm. For a small amount of money. So I found that, you know, going the family office route, going to people who weren't doing emerging managers. And if you look, when Daryl Carter, Quentin, Victor McFarlane, all the pioneers, Rich McCoy, when all these guys started, there were no programs. So right. It was hard for them to get money, but they said once we convinced people, then it was like, okay, you are, you know, you have an acquisitions platform, you're a developer. They didn't put that emerging in front of it.
Right.
So the emerging thing, I find it can be helpful when you're getting started, but a lot of times it's putting you in the ghetto. And so that's how come I don't even like to say emerging. People can look at our website and see that three partners, two of us are Black, but I don't even like to say Black controlled firm, because when I do, all of a sudden it's like, oh, you can go do this program and they'll say stuff like, well, we want to keep the rents affordable and we're not going to sell for 15 years. And I remember one time I said, wait a minute. I don't want to sell 15 years. When do we get paid?
Right.
You know, so it can be an opportunity, but I just think you have to be careful with it. And affordable is definitely a need. Yeah. But if I was starting over again, I'd probably rather be a developer of affordable as opposed to doing acquisitions.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really interesting because, you know, a lot of those programs, like you said, you hear about a lot of them, but then you don't hear about a lot of that money actually flowing out, you know, from those coffers oftentimes because it is the 20-page application. Yeah. Or it's you got to do affordable, or, you know, like you say, it's not enough money to really give you scale. It's a lot of those things, you know, so it's a challenge.
Yeah. It's a challenge. And you'll notice that in private equity, I mean, everybody knows about Vista, you know, Robert Smith, you know, billionaire.
Yep.
There are a lot of brothers, more than most people realize, in private equity who have billions of dollars under management.
Mm-hmm.
There are even some younger brothers who are starting to get some traction in VC. When you look around our area in real estate, you'll notice that there are not that many people who've been able to get to scale. And you go to some big cities, and it's embarrassing, the lack of diversity in the business. So I think that's another thing you have to consider. You got to look at the business, and it's hard to get to scale for a lot of Black-owned firms in real estate. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, you know, but if you have been able to do
harder.
It. But, you know, it's 2023, and I wish I could say, here's 15 firms.
Mm-hmm.
They're not.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's really amazing. I mean, I bring that up for a specific reason, because here you are, the former guy that ran multifamily for Fannie Mae, and yet and still you said it was a challenge and took a long time. I mean, if anybody knows this space, you do. So, I mean, it's kind of crazy. You know, we talked about that. You may remember a little bit in New York at the New York Common Meeting.
Yeah.
Back a few years back. It was like, you know, what do you got to do here?
Well, you know, I always tell people that it's like I'm in Fannie Mae one day, and, you know, you got everybody saying, well, you know, Ken, visionary, a great strategist, a great leader, and you're a tremendous force in this business. You walk out the door, and next day you put on the entrepreneurial hat, and then I said, you know, you
just like, a kid who? With a dream, you know? Kid who? Who? I don't know no kid.
That's right. No, I mean, I used to joke when I left. You know, I call people, and I call up people I do business with, say, hey, it's Ken Bacon. Look, I want to talk to you. Hello. And I don't get angry about it, but I will tell you that there were a couple examples where I saw people who didn't report directly to me. Sometimes they didn't even report to people who reported to me, who went out and got money. You know, I don't know if a lot of you ever saw the Eddie Murphy skit on Saturday Night Live, where he put on the white makeup and he went to the bank and he said,
oh, yeah, with the wig and all that. Yeah.
I remember that. He said, oh, here's the money. You want more?
Yeah.
So that's just reality. I think you just have to accept the fact that if you're Black or a woman, if you're not part of the old boy network, it's going to be harder, but it's not impossible.
Yeah. And I think that's the point. You know, there's kind of the mantra behind this show is basically to make that point.
Yeah.
You know, that it can be done. You know, you look around and I don't know, minorities in commercial real estate are 3% or 6% or something like that. You know, so it's all spread out all over the country, but it does happen, you know, and that's kind of where it's at. So,
yeah, I mean, when I look at Daryl, I look at what Tammy has been able to do at Basis.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Jair. I mentioned Bua, you know, Don Peoples. I mean, there are people out there doing it.
Yeah.
But like I said, it's a struggle. And as long as you know that when you start, that's the main thing to know.
Right. And most people, if they don't have that entrepreneurial upbringing, they miss that. So let me do this. I don't know. We got an echo all of a sudden going on here. I don't know how that happened, but we're pretty much right at the top of the hour. I wanted to ask you about two other things real quick.
Yeah.
Student housing and senior housing. I'm going to combine them just for the sake of time. What's your thoughts on that? You mentioned about a lot of schools that you might buy nearby because that's kind of the anchor for that area.
Yeah.
You also mentioned hospitals. So that made me think about student housing and senior housing. You know, where's your mind on that as it relates to that part of the market?
Student housing, I say be cautious, be careful, because the demographics are such the college age population is going down. So you can make a lot, but there's a big difference between being at close to Ohio State or Florida, a big state university that's going to get funding and that will always be full versus going to Podunk State, Second Baptist University that might be private with a small endowment that's really finding it hard to compete for students. So I think student, you really have to pick your spots. Seniors housing is hard because it's not a traditional real estate business, depending on what you do. But at Welltower, you know, the pandemic hit assisted living very hard, it hit nursing homes very hard. But the demographics of the country are such that, you know, we're aging out. The average age of the country is increasing. So I think independent living, assisted living, Welltower is doing something called wellness housing, which is multifamily built with the construction techniques and amenities that are appealing to people in you know, in their 50s and 60s. I think that, again, you have to pick your spots, but I think that's going to be a growing business. So I'm very bullish about that business.
Okay. All right. But that makes sense. I don't think you have any in your portfolio right now, though.
Not like I say, I don't do it at Railfield, but, you know, clearly at Welltower, I'm back. I just got notes about some deals they're looking at today. So Welltower has done very well and will continue to be a leader in that.
Gotcha. It sounds good. And we certainly appreciate that. You know, maybe another time we'll talk about, you know, your success on being on boards. I know you're on the Comcast Xfinity board and some of these other boards, and we'll save that for another day. But, you know, we're like I said, at the top of the hour. It's been a fantastic conversation, a lot of insight. I'm sure a lot of people have benefited from this. What parting words do you have for us and for the next generation of CRE executives that are listening today?
I want to close with something from the great philosopher Bernice Teresa Narcisse Bacon, my mother.
Okay.
And one time when I was at a low point on Wall Street, somebody beat me up my bonus. And my mother said, I called my mother and she said, what's wrong? And I told her, she said, boy, you're too old and too black to expect life to be fair. So get over it. I don't want to hear you complaining or crying. Tell me what you're going to do to deal with it. And that's the parting advice I'd have to people, that, you know, life ain't fair. It's tough out there. But if you get caught up in being a victim and complaining and hurting, you'll never get anywhere. So you just have to tighten up, get tough, and persevere, have faith, and you'll make it. And there are enough of us out here doing it that I'm more optimistic about that than I might have been 30 years ago. I think there's opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, very good point. Very good point. And like you said, there is being done. So if others could do it, you could do it too.
There we go.
Yep, just got to be at it. So, well, Ken, hey, man, it's always great to catch up. I thank you for sharing 60 minutes with us and going through this information. Hey, 60 minutes. Maybe that's something I got to think about coining for this show.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much, man. It's been great. And I look forward to catching up with you soon.
Okay, take care, brother.
All right, bye. We'll see you later. You've been listening to Mornings with Joel, Commercial Real Estate Podcast, where we focus on rising stars and established players in commercial real estate and talk to them about how they are building legacies in today's marketplace. Please check back weekly to hear our upcoming guests.